Connect the Dots with Allison Rose Levy, Saturdays at noon, Eastern, on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots, and I'm Allison Rose Levy with you on today's show. I'm a Huffington Post blogger and a 25-year green and health journalist, and I write connecting the dots between everything that affects our personal health and our total health environment. That means our food, our farming, our society, our attitudes, our economy, and we discuss all of that because actually health does not exist in isolation. We're not like little beings in a space suit separated from everybody and everything else here on planet Earth. It's all connected, and that's what our show is about. So this week, given some very exciting new developments in our time, much needed, I'm going to be focusing on the economy, on economic factors and our attitudes and options about how we look at things, economic, financing, and money. I know all listeners to PRN are aware of the uprising, the resistance movement that's begun by Occupy Wall Street, and I begin every program with an activist link, and then we do more throughout the show depending on our guests. So our guest today is going to be discussing this, but meanwhile, I just want to give all our listeners the website through which you can contribute to support this effort. You can send money. You can send food. You could send your used and clean business attire as costumes or clothing for the people down in Wall Street, and this movement is now is going nationwide as well, who are offering resistance as the 99% of the country where 1% holds most of the wealth. So you can go to OccupyWallStreet.org, and that's where you can contribute and get current updates about all the activities down there. If you're in New York City, as I am, tomorrow Bill McKibben is going to be down at Wall Street, and I'll certainly be there, and I'm sure a lot of people will be. And if you're not in New York, this movement is springing up all around the country. You can find a site near you, and you can also contribute anything you're able to. So thank you for your support. Connect the Dots theme music is The Garden by Bobby McFerrin. And every week I have to say that when we do the show and that music comes on, I always feel happy at the reminder that we're living in a garden. And, you know, the world is a garden. And also want to mention that we'll be having ongoing coverage of Occupy Wall Street here on the Progressive Network. So you can come to our website and stay tuned. My guest on today's show is somebody who's been thinking long and hard and writing and teaching and leading and developing new ways of organizing ourselves economically on, you know, the very issues that are really up for us right now. So I'm so delighted he can join us this week. It's Woody Tash. He's the founder and chairman of Slow Money, a nonprofit organization formed back in 2008 that actually is looking at different ways to support the roots of what we basically need in our society and to shift investment towards the things that are really basically nourishing and supporting all people, you know, rather than kind of isolating wealth. A reader named Woody, one of the 25 visionaries who are changing our world. He has a conference upcoming this week. Very excited about that. It's taking place in San Francisco. It's a gathering of the Slow Money people, and you can participate in that, and we'll talk more about that throughout the program. And he also has a new book that we'll talk more about. It's called Inquiries into the Nature of Slow Money. So welcome to our show, Woody. So delighted to have you.
Hi. Thanks very much for having me.
You know, I have to ask you first the most kind of obvious question. In this last week, we have, you know, kind of more and more momentum being gained by Occupy Wall Street on the one hand, and the other biggest news item of the week in most people's minds has been the passing of a sort of a classic or regarded as an innovative and visionary entrepreneur CEO, Steve Jobs. You know, I'd love to hear your comments on those two events and what that has to teach us, the confluence of, you know, looking at the passing of a CEO and what that figure represents for America, and looking at, you know, now this rising popular resistance to this concentration of wealth that is represented by Wall Street. I'd love to hear your comments on the intersect there.
Do you have any big topics you'd like to talk about?
I know it's kind of a heavy question to begin with.
Yeah,
but.
Well, let's do the Occupy movement first.
Okay.
And my thoughts about this run as follows. I'd love to avoid giving away my age, but I think I can't. So let's say someone who came of age in the 60s, the late 60s and early 70s, meaning was a young adult then, and let's say had his formative political years, you know, during the war in Vietnam and Watergate and all of the unrest that happened at that time. It's really interesting to see an attempt to go back into the streets now. You know, my first reaction is, of course, I think what many of your listeners will share the reaction that taking to the streets in a peaceful way for something you really believe in is the very essence of democracy and is a great thing. And so, obviously, you know, I raise my fist in solidarity with that. And I'm actually very conscious of the image of a fist up in the air because, not going back to the late 60s, but because The Economist magazine had a cover about 6 months ago on the Arab Spring that had a big fist up in the air and it said, "The Awakening." Mm. And I'd like to think what we are trying to do now is have an awakening in the American public, in the American mind, about where our money is going. You know, are there things we can really do differently or not? And my one concern about the Occupy movement is that it not get too negative, not be about dragging the bums out of their office and, you know, dragging them off to jail, but be a little bit more about what can we do differently going forward? How do we take that concern? And, as you know, there's a lot of negative energy out there. There's fear, there's disgust, there's frustration, you know, all kinds of energy, which is a little bit akin to the energy that brings Tea Party up people, too, on the other side of the political spectrum. It's just being so pissed off at the dysfunction that we have to do something. And I'm right there with everybody on that. What we're doing at Slow Money is you know, maybe turning it a little bit to the side and saying, okay, let's take that energy and put it into something positive. Let's start taking our money out of that system. Not all of it, just some of it at the beginning, because, you know, we're not going to invent everything. You know, Rome wasn't built in a day, I guess, to use a terrible metaphor. But we need to take some of our money out of there and start putting it to work near where we live, rebuilding our communities, saving farms, rebuilding our food system, getting healthy food in the schools, all the rest of the stuff that we all know we need. And we know we need it, but we don't take our money and put it to work in that way. And so don't let me rant too much more. We'll talk about it some more. But those are some of my general reactions on the Occupy movement.
Mm-hmm.
As far as Steve Jobs goes, boy, I don't know. That's an interesting question. I don't think I have any special insight into that. You know, I'm sitting here at my desk looking at my MacBook Air.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm someone who has, let's say, occasionally Luddite tendencies, but who's also very fond of things that work well and that are designed well. But I guess my real when I think of Steve Jobs, I think of it a little bit from the iconoclastic design standpoint more than anything, more than the CEO standpoint. I just think of him as somebody who had the guts and the vision to, you know, follow his own instinct in designing things that really worked for a lot of people. And, you know, he was famous for not doing focus groups and just designing for himself, in a sense, confident that if it worked for him, there'd be millions of other people who would want what he wants. And that's a pretty beautiful thing. I mean, in the world of corporate this and that and strategic this and that and, you know, consulting this and that and all of the different, let's say, design by committee, design by focus group, design by, you know, demographics, all these different things, I think that is beyond refreshing. Someone who's really willing to design more from his intuition and his heart and then deliver things that really work for millions of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting because, you know, there are people who, in looking at, you know, all the responses and comments and everything, because I'm always sort of out in the social media blogosphere and hearing a lot, kind of doing informal market research all the time on the different things that people are talking about and reflecting upon. You know, it seemed to kind of go both ways in that he was not innovative in terms of his, either his philanthropic gifting or in terms of his, you know, employee policies in terms of like reseeding this country, for example, through jobs. You know, was not as productive as might have, you know, as many people pointed out. And yet, on the other hand, he was a kind of model individualistic visionary who kind of went with his vision and really affected and created a great deal of things that were beneficial from that. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that that I've been hearing a lot. You know, speaking of the whole jobs thing, just one more question, and then we'll move on more directly to slow money, which is, just in the last hour or so, Mayor Bloomberg of New York has critiqued the Occupy Wall Street movement, saying that they're attacking jobs. And, you know, the whole concern over jobs, we also hear there that gas fracking, which is poised to invade New York State. It's something that I have a story I broke on Huffington and cover regularly, both on Huffington and on this show. You know, we're here that will create jobs, and that becomes the rationale. It's also really up there in terms of the up-and-coming top-level Wall Street investments, you know, that people want to be putting money into at this time, and yet we know that fracking chemicals can pollute water. It's coming into the region of our sustainable agriculture north of the city in New York State. It's already in our neighboring state of Pennsylvania. And the battle cry is investment in jobs. Now here is Mayor Bloomberg critiquing the Occupy Wall Street movement, just basically saying, well, this creates jobs, you know. I'd love to hear your thoughts on, you know, and so that immediately, well, everybody wants jobs, particularly in an economy where, you know, where we're having more unemployment and people are underpaid and struggling economically. I'd love to hear a slow money perspective on, you know, that dichotomy.
Well, I think basically on all such issues, the challenge is to think with a long enough time frame to imagine, let's say, alternative. I think the best term to use is structural solutions. You know, Joseph Stiglitz, mm-hmm. you know, a Nobel Prize winning economist who has, let's say, come out more on the right side of things than the wrong from my perspective and talking about where we are and where we need to go. He said a couple of years ago on a Charlie Rose show, Charlie, we're not fixing the structural problems of the economy because we don't know what the structural problems are, which is, you know, it's a fairly striking thing for an economist to say. And, mm-hmm. and I think the reason the jobs questions of, you know, this versus that, or we need this tomorrow, or we need the pipeline because it's going to create 20,000 jobs, and we need this and we need that, those are all very short-term, very myopic kind of either-or things. And, of course, when you look at the bigger picture, there is no either-or. There's just one big thing that we all have to try to figure out how to live on and how to pass along, you know, no worse off than we got it, or maybe even better than we found it. And so where I'm going with this is thinking about here's a jobs number that will never be discussed in the current public debate. In 1900, there were 50 million farmers in the United States.
Hmm.
Think how crazy that is compared to where we are. Think how crazy where we are now is. There were 50 million farmers out of, I don't even know what the population was in 1900. It was probably 100, maybe it was 100 million. Maybe mm-hmm. it was 125 million.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, roughly half the population were farmers.
Mm-hmm.
Now less than 2 million people are farmers, but that statistic is, I think, somewhat deceptive because it's something like 165,000 farms produce 70% of the farm income in this country, meaning a very small number of very large industrial farms account for most of the farm income. And by the way, I would say as a disclaimer, I'm not an economist. I'm a kind of a self-taught financier, small-time venture capitalist, you know, mm-hmm. entrepreneur type person. So I don't really listen to macro statistics that much because I think they can be manipulated. They're so abstract that people can't relate to them. But this is a statistic that means something to me, meaning half of our population was involved in producing food about 100 years ago. And 100 years in the sweep of history is nothing. Mm-hmm. Right? Now we're all confused because everyone has essentially moved into the city, you know, bought iPods, if we want to make a little doff our caps to Steve, and then is confused, right, because we've all just become consumers. And now the only way to grow the economy is to produce more consumption, get people out there to buy more things, and just kind of keep this treadmill going. Well, you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to realize that's kind of a dead end as an economic model. I mean, my God, is that the only way out, just to get more people sitting in more cities, consuming more stuff, and somehow create a few more jobs along the way before we all go off the edge of the cliff? So this, so I can't offer, you know, I don't pretend to have an answer to, let's say, an either-or thing in the short term of 20,000 jobs here, 20,000 jobs there. I think our, the real task is to reserve some part of our thought process and our activism for long-term solutions that might actually make a real structural difference over a period of a few generations. Mm-hmm. That, to me, means we need a million or two more new organic farms in this country. We need to rebuild local. And by the way, I'm sorry if I bring everything back to kind of what I'm doing, but that's the perils of being a social entrepreneur. Of you kind course. Of see everything through the lens of what you're doing. But I do believe this is a one little dot. You talk about connecting dots. I think this is one dot that needs to be reconnected to everyone's thought process. We need to rebuild local food distribution, local processing. You know, the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker. It sounds kind of stupid. It sounds kind of nostalgic, but it really isn't. You know, if you look at what's happened to the culture of small towns around the United States, if anyone ventures out of the cities and goes really into the heartland of the country to see where the corn and the soybeans are grown and where the hogs are raised, you may be a little bit surprised at what you find. There are a lot of really, what's the word, degraded towns. I'm not talking about the soil, which is being degraded. That's a whole other issue. I'm talking about the culture in the towns. You can drive through a town in Iowa and have basically half the stores on Main Street be boarded up because of the consolidation and the job loss and et cetera. So here's one approach. Again, a lot to talk about here, obviously, so I'll stop in a second. But the big sweep of it is think about creating jobs in a totally different way, a long-term, multi-generational way. And in our case, we think rebuilding food systems around the country is a way to create millions of jobs. It's a different way. It's not a way to make zillions of dollars in the course of creating those jobs, which, of course, you know, while I don't know exactly what Mayor Bloomberg was referring to, other than a knee-jerk thing about jobs, there are jobs and then there are jobs, you know. And the jobs that are created in, let's say, industrial, high-tech manufacturing sectors are one kind of job. That is one kind of job. So-called service jobs, that's another kind of job. I think jobs, growing food, processing food, delivering healthy food is something we sorely need a lot more of.
Hear, hear. This actually ties into what's been an ongoing theme of this program because of the fact that New York's state in New York City is actually in the next several weeks making a decision. October, it's not really very far off. It's about 2 weeks away. October 21st will be made a decision whether or not fracking can occur in the river valley of the Delaware River, which feeds 15 million people. New York State is then poised to allow fracking in upstate regions where all the sustainable agriculture is. And I'm someone actually who's an upstate downstate person, and I have been for a while going back and forth between the city where, you know, I write and report and grew up, and the country where I live in a rural area. And because of the decline of farms there, of dairy farms there, and the subsidies all going to the, you know, the very few farms that you mentioned, we have a declining farm region, and these are the very people who are selling large tracts of land to be fracked for gas. And thus we are, you know, not only at high risk of polluting air and water, but we're actually giving up the ghost on what is our agricultural region, what is our food supply region, our local food supply region. And there's a big disconnect between the urban environment where people are foodies down in the city and they love healthy food and they go to restaurants, they do yoga, and they do all these health-oriented things. But any kind of focus on our upstate agricultural region, it's like you were talking about outer space. I mean, there's just a huge disconnect. I would love to see New York as a pilot project for the slow food movement rebuild of sustainable agriculture, because instead of selling out that region to contaminate it, we should be investing in that and to create a food shed for New York City. I mean, that's what you know, would that fit the slow food model? I mean, how does an area go about that?
Well, you've hit on so many core issues there, and I think the most important one is reconnecting. This is why food, when you discuss food, it's not really just about food, in my opinion. It really is about the whole structure of society and broad sweep of history. I mean, I know those sound like kind of grandiose terms, but what you're talking about is reconnecting people to one another and to the places where they live and to the land. You know, it couldn't be more basic. And this is why the local food movement is one of the reasons it's so important, because it does really reconnect people. When people belong to a CSA, a community-supported agriculture farm, where everyone buys a share of the farm produce at the beginning of the farm season. There are 400,000 Americans that now belong to a CSA. And I don't know if that strikes you as a large number or a small number, but I would say in the scheme of things, it's still a relatively small number of people.
Yeah,
a lot of
I think it's a small number, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. What is so beautiful? I mean, there are 50,000 people in Copenhagen alone belong to a CSA. So mm-hmm. belong to one, they call it a box scheme there. It's an organic home delivery service. So that's in one city. In Europe, 50,000 people belong to a single one. So, yeah, 400,000 is a small number in the United States. And the beauty of a CSA is it's hundreds or in some cases thousands of customers who kind of hold hands with the farmer at the beginning of the farm season, provide the farmer with his or her budget for the entire farm season, and in return get a share of whatever he or she produces in the year. So if there are 100 CSA members, they each get 1/100th of the farm produce that year. And this is at the core of slow food, which is about reconnecting the food consumer with the food producer. You know, less than 10 cents of every food dollar that is spent in the United States goes to a farmer. So just, you know, if we want to think about a few of these statistics to just kind of get us focused. Mm. Less than 10 cents. You know, where's the rest go? Processing, distribution, advertising, retailing, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So a CSA connects the consumer directly to the producer. How beautiful is that? Mm-hmm. So it gets rid of all those layers of intermediation. And I'm giving that as an example because of the way you frame, let's say, upstate and downstate. You know, we are completely disconnected from the way our food is produced. Mm-hmm. If it shows up in the store or it shows up on the restaurant plate, people don't think about some really basic things. There are long-term, let's say, social and environmental things, and then there are very short-term defensive kind of like avoid the collapse things to do, just really basic kind of self-defense things, like to realize that how many days would people in New York last if the truck stopped rolling? How many days of food are there in the stores? And I don't know the statistics in New York per se, but in general, the answer is 3 or 4 days, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
There are several days of food in all of the stores. Now, I'm not saying, you know, is there going to be that kind of horrible disruption to the supply chain? Well, probably not all at once, but common sense would tell you, just on that basis alone, we need to reconnect to more localized production. We need to know where the food is coming from, what needs to be more accessible to us, in case the 1,500 or the 2,000-mile trip that most of our food takes, you know, is no longer possible. Now, there's a lot of other issues, too, in terms of just the social benefits and the political benefits of people being reconnected on a regional basis that I think, you know, are also worth exploring.
When you talk about CSAs, you know, New York City dwellers have farmers markets. So, you know, they consider that what we've been taught is that if we act as a consumer, and of course, that's the beginning, we act as a consumer. We don't buy the processed food. We buy the healthy food at the farmers market. But then we don't look a step further to say, who is the farmer? Where is that coming from? I did a piece in Huffington in the last couple of weeks because Hurricane Irene and Storm Lee, you know, induced bad flooding in some of the regions that are feeding the food co-op in the city, the farmers markets. And so, you know, some of these adverse effects, you know, one looks to one's immediate environment. This is how it's affecting me right where I am. But we also have to look at how it affects the farms and the foods. And there's a whole region that supplies food to New York that lost their entire fall crop due to that storm, for example. And I've been covering it and following those farmers and everything, but very few people are aware or interested. It's like we've created this, I think part of it is also the economic pressure in our culture. Everybody's so desperate to focus on whatever they're doing through which they're surviving and their small little piece of it, you know, that it's very hard to either look at the bigger picture or to look at what real priorities might look like. Do you have a process for that with, slow money? I mean, how do you, in addition to encouraging people to get involved in CSAs and participate in everything, how do you get people involved in reconnecting in that way?
It's funny, I've never said it like this before, but I'm going to answer your question. Yeah, we have a process. It's called thinking, talking, and doing. In fact, we always talk about the triple bottom line, and I think I'm going to put this into one of my talks from it. This is my new triple bottom line, thinking, talking, and doing.
Uh-huh.
So the thinking part, this is going to sound a little crazy as I started, but just stick with me. The thinking part, to me, the thinking and the talking part is what allows the doing to happen. And I think in our culture, we rush so much to the doing. Oh, you know, what's the deal? Oh, where can I invest here? Give me the thing I can invest in. Here's $1,000. You go do it. It's all about the immediate transaction, someone making it easy for us, a package, as opposed to a process of reconnecting and reorienting and, let's say, reevaluating, which is what we desperately need. So now I'll tell you what we're doing in slow money to answer your question. We have something called the slow money principles. Very, very simple. It's a little one-pager that is, in a way, a synopsis of my book. You mentioned the book, so I'll just say the book kind of catalyzed this discussion around the country among tens of thousands of people, and we hope maybe it'll go to larger numbers, in the months and years ahead. And that discussion is about the disconnect between money and the soil. Mm-hmm. That's one way of framing it very simply. It's, wow. Where's our money going and what's happening to soil fertility? And isn't soil fertility one of the ultimate measures of our sustainability? If we're destroying life in the soil, how long are we going to survive? There's a whole bunch of amazing facts about the soil that once I kind of followed my nose into this, really were, woke me up talking about awakenings. Mm-hmm. And so that discussion about money in the soil, reorients us away from this idea that buying low and selling high is the only way economics can work, and everybody, the whole invisible hand myth that everybody just trying to make as much money as they can will somehow kind of lead everyone in the right direction. You can hear the immediate, overlays to the Occupy Wall Street thing almost in everything we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. But that discussion really causes people to, quote, slow down a little bit, step outside of the everyday economic transactions that they're doing, and kind of have a different perspective. Then we talk to one another about that. That's the thinking part. The talking part is being with other people who have the same questions you do. And guess what? There are millions of us. I don't know how many millions, but I'm convinced from traveling around the country the last 3 years talking to many thousands of people that there are millions out there who basically share exactly the same concerns. I kind of know deep down that things are broken. I kind of know deep down that when I buy this product, plug in the name of any company you want, including Apple, and buy this product, it's made in China and it's this, that. We've got all these environmental and social concerns, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't know what to do about it. To your point, Allison, I wake up every day, I have to do my thing, I need an iPod, I need my computer, so I buy the best one I can find and I try not to worry about it too much. But there are millions of us who know how broken the system is.
Mm-hmm.
Who know the conditions in which our food are grown. In the back of our mind, we know about migrant workers. We know about the depletion of the aquifers. We know about endocrine disruptors and carbon emissions and all this. We know in the back of our minds it's all there, but we can't act on it every single day. But being with other people who are voicing these concerns in public, just like it is on Wall Street today, but doing it not out of a protest mode, but out of a what are we going to do about a mode together going forward? And, of course, we're focused about money and investing. That leads to the doing part. The doing part is once you think differently and once you can be with other people who are sharing your same concerns, we are just rolling our sleeves up. And this is going to sound, hopefully, amazingly simple after all these big issues we're talking about. We're taking a little of our money, and we're starting to invest in small food enterprises near where we live. I mean, could it be any more basic than that? I don't see how it could. Now, that is being called a revolution by some media people and a movement by many people and whatnot. And I'm 60 years old. I didn't wake up to start a movement for sure. But I find it really intriguing that something this commonsensical could be called a revolution. What does that say about where we are as a civilization? That investing 1%, we talk about getting a million Americans to invest 1% of our money in local food systems within a decade. And that's a revolution? So again, let's go back to our fists in the air. What the heck? You know, put our fists up, right on. You know, but it's a positive revolution. So in terms of what we are doing, if you just let me go again a little bit more, and I'll be now very specific. What we are actually doing is bringing people together nationally once in a while. We've been doing it once a year. This is our third one coming up next week in San Francisco, October 12th to 14th at Fort Mason in San Francisco. We will have probably 750, 850. We don't know the final numbers yet, but, you know, a good number of people together from probably 35 states and several foreign countries. We will have 30 food entrepreneurs from around the country, you know, grass-fed beef and local processing, companies making, you know, biologically benign inputs for sustainable farming. There's a whole gamut of small food-related entrepreneurs who are kind of leading the way, rebuilding local food systems. And we are going to spend 3 days together talking about big picture, some of the big issues that you and I have already been talking about, and then also going right down to the ground to micro, how do we put money into these companies and other companies like them around the country. And I'd like listeners to also know that, you know, we have roughly 18 chapters now, slow money chapters with a small C that have emerged over the last year. This is all very much emergent. Just in the last year around the country, and they have started doing a similar process at a smaller scale, in other words, smaller groups of people getting together to, you know, everywhere from Maine, North Carolina, Wisconsin, Seattle area, Boulder, Colorado, St. Louis, really all over the country.
Well, it sounds like we have to start one in New York.
Okay, yeah. Oh, well, I should have mentioned New York, so I'm sorry to mention New York. There is a Slow Money New York chapter. It's based in Brooklyn.
Fantastic.
There's going to be an immediate benefit to your to listeners in the Brooklyn area. At our national gathering last year, which it was in Vermont, one of the attendees met the entrepreneurs who run Fleischer's Meats, which is in Kingston, New York. It's a butcher shop that handles only organic grass-fed meats. And based on their meeting at our event last year, they are now opening a second Fleischer's. It's going to be opening in Park Slope. I don't know the exact opening date, but more than $500,000 of investment occurred to allow Fleischer's to open their second shop, you know, in the New York area.
Oh, that's
cool.
Yeah, I'm aware of that, actually, because they're going to be staying at the home
of a friend. Meeting each other and finding ways to put some money to work in small food enterprises that will help, you know, will help organics and local food expand as a share of the American food system.
That's fantastic. We're going to have to take our kind of halftime break here, but this is really interesting. I want to talk with you more about that because, actually, I know the people in Brooklyn you're talking about. So talk about a small world, even in a big city, right? I want to just point listeners, before we take the break here, which we're taking momentarily, to the website for this fantastic event that's happening, your conference gathering next week. It's at slowmoney.org. You can go there to read the principles. You can also order Woody's book there, and you can see who's speaking, and if you're in the area, you can participate or find local gathering groups near you. That's at slowmoney.org, and stay with us at Connect the Dots as we take this break. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and we'll be back for more talk with Woody Tash about Slow Money. Welcome back, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and today I'm talking with Woody Tash, the author of the book Inquiries into the Nature of Slow Money. And it's actually published by Chelsea Green, which is a wonderful press, if you don't know it, and they've actually done many terrific books. I recommend that you go to their website and look for this book and read it. And we're talking with Woody today about slow money. You know, one of the things that's interesting about slow is, you know, we're kind of taught everything should be fast, everything should be big. And what you're talking about is really, it actually reminds me of the I Ching, a movement of the power of the small. You know, there's one way that we've gone toward the power of the small. Small, which is a hexagram of the ancient Chinese book of knowledge, the I Ching, in saying, you know, that the let's just do small things. And there's a way in which we do that where we kind of do small things, like we take care of our own health or we eat organic food in a way that's very self-contained and individualistic and limiting. And then there's another way of kind of expanding that a little and doing small things in a way that recycles and gives back and creates a different flow and energy in the larger system. It's kind of almost like composting. You know, you take some for yourself and then you give back some. And so your notion, Woody, of investing in whatever way is possible for you on a local level in something as basic as your local food and agriculture is really an expansion of the small beyond just the individual self to really contribute to the whole. And I think it's really quite beautiful. You know, why do we either have a disconnect where it's like, I do this small individualistic thing, or we think we have to do things that are big and fast and mass and, you know, like you've really created a really interesting and subtly different message that has a lot of richness in it. Why do we kind of distrust the small in a certain sense?
That's a great question. Yeah, I'm not sure if I would. I'm not sure if I know how to answer that the way you framed it. Meaning, we distrust the small. I think we are seduced more. I think it's more like we're seduced into the big. You know, we're distracted by the big. I mean, how can we not be when you know you're talking billions and trillions and mega this and mega that, and you know there is something seductive about it. I mean, I think we have to all admit that there's something seductive about it. There's something seductive about a big city and a tall building. You know, there's something seductive about a celebrity, let's say, which is just another manifestation of the same thing. So our distraction goes, you know, we get distracted away from our daily lives into that big thing out there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the bright lights, I don't know if anyone, I'm sure someone must have said this, the bright lights of cyberspace, because it's kind of an oxymoron, but whatever, the excitement of everything that's out there and the titillation of just being able to instantaneously go here and there and see all the stuff, that is titillating and it is seductive. It does distract us from how we comport ourselves, you know, in our daily lives. But I think there's another element to it, which is in today's world, the problems have become so big. In other words, you know, when you live in a time where you have to have an opinion about things like, is our generation ending life for future generations? You know, are we really killing 200 species a day? Are we, you know, are GMOs, you know, dangerously unraveling the web of life? Are we tinkering with the very, you know, genetic code? I mean, my God, how much bigger, how much more horrible do things have to be? You know, is you know, global warming, you know, for real? And are we causing it? And can we stop it? Mm-hmm. So, whatever you think about those things, they are now topics of discussion that every educated person on the planet has to have some opinion about. Those are big. Those are super big. And so there's a tendency to think, okay, big problems, they must need enormous solutions because we've just got to, like, invent our way out of it. We've got to invent a huge vacuum cleaner that's going to suck all the carbon out of the atmosphere or something. We've got to come up with some big solution.
Uh-huh.
And but I really appreciate the way you framed that question, Alison, because I think the millions of people that I'm, you know, suggesting are, you know, anxious to have this discussion, I think know in their hearts that there is nothing other than the way we all do things every day. That is, the totality of the big is just contained in all the things we do every day. So if there's some way to just reconnect ourselves to that feeling that, it really does matter where I buy my food, not just to me, and I really like the way you framed the compost thing about giving some back on it. That's what the whole ethos is. It's like we're connected. It's not just about me putting healthier food in my body so I can take care of the temple of my body. Okay, that's not a bad thing to really care about your body and want to put good stuff in it. But it's about, by doing this, I'm really taking care of everybody else's body too. And I'm taking care of all the living organisms that produce the food. Not just because it's a nice idea, which it is, but because really we're at a point where survival of all the interconnected living things really depends on it. Possibly our survival. You know, more likely the survival of our kids, and even more likely not the survival of their kids.
Mhm. Mhm. Yeah, that's quite amazing. That's quite fantastic, really. I mean, that's a way of framing it. So, in effect, this is a very immediate way to begin in a way that's self and community connected in a very direct sense, and that actually builds relationship to some of the bigger things that we sometimes feel distracted by, or that we feel helpless in the face of, that we can't possibly have an effect and an influence upon. One of the things that in the integrative health movement, which is in spirituality movement, which I come out of, was there was always this sense of, well, if I change myself personally, you know, if I'm my best self, if I work on my issues, if I'm healthy, if I this, if I radiate spiritual consciousness or whatever, then, you know, then if enough of us are doing this, it will automatically shift things. And, you know, it's a beautiful notion, and it's been a fascinating experiment. But with the way things are going now and the concerns that you mentioned, you know, which is very much all that I report on and everything everywhere, you know, it seems like we just can't rely upon that alone. And so what I really love about this is a way of building a bridge to the community in the most direct way that you can see back. I'm actually very inspired by it because it really, I mean, in New York, we have a problem with these upstate farms that have been affected by weather change and that are supplying our food. And I actually, some of the farmers are coming down to the city for a fundraiser, and I said, well, you know, and they're like, well, we want to come, but, oh, it's such a big deal coming down there, and then we have to pay for this expensive hotel, and down there is where the money is, and it's so fast, and we don't really like it. And I said, well, why don't you just crash at my apartment? And, you know, I was, we also have this individualistic idea, you know, that everybody has to solve their own problems by themselves, or it's some kind of a failure or a dishonor, or, you know, it's a one shouldn't have to ask, and it's kind of ugly to have to be in a problem. You know, you're defined in the society as a loser, you know, rather, you know, if your farm was flooded or something, you know, rather than regarding it as we should feel responsible for them. They grow our food, you know, and whatever small thing we can supply that would be helpful would be good, you know, would be good.
Well, you said a key word earlier in those remarks. You said a key word, the word was relationship. I want to highlight that and say this is, you know, a big part of what we're doing in Slow Money is moving, let's say, from a transaction-driven idea of economics to a relationship-based idea, meaning, again, if you use a CSA model, if you know the person you're buying the food from, it doesn't get any more direct than that, right? So if you know the person and you know where the food came from, that's you enter in, and it's particularly if you're buying it in a CSA, meaning where you have a different kind of economic relationship. That's no longer just a transaction. That is a relationship-based kind of transaction. And that's a big part of what we're doing, because everything we just said, all about small actions and, let's say, you know, increased awareness of our connection to the whole, all of these different things, and how we understand our health is connected to the health of the whole system. If we don't attach money to that, if we don't figure out how to make our money work in accordance to that, we can do all the yoga we want. And I'm just going to sound a little brash, and forgive me if I say it this way, but, you know, we can eat all the organic food we want. We can do all the yoga we want. We can do all the personal work we want. But if our money is still zooming around the planet, destroying the web of life, I don't think that the rest of that really matters that much. In the grand scheme of things, we may create some temporary well-being for ourselves, in a sense, in isolation from that destructive system. But, you know, in the 20th century, we had the luxury of maybe not paying attention to all this because we didn't know about it. But now we know about it. So I don't think we can just keep giving our money to other people, letting them invest in things that will make money for our retirement, and make believe we don't know about all the negative consequences that the circulation of that money is causing. So I'm saying all that because you can't really have healthy relationships. I don't think behind it is this horrible alienated thing that we're trying to make believe isn't there. And so I just want to add one other thing that comes back to the small. That's a big, audacious, horrible kind of thing to contemplate. And then we just get to, okay, what are we going to do about it? We're just going to start doing some small investing in food things because we can't solve the whole thing, you know, from the top down. Actually, Allison, if you just let me, I want to tie back to one other thread. We were talking earlier about big versus small and the big solutions. So much philanthropy and so much political contributions and all, it goes to big, so, you know, we have to regulate. We have to change the farm bill. We have to get so-and-so elected. we have to do all this. Now, I'm not against all those things. Those are kind of like the horrible inevitabilities of, you know, the things we're stuck in given our predicament. But I am against that being the only approach. You know, that we have to do that, but then we also have to take some of our time, energy, and money and just step completely outside that, because you can, there are a lot of very good arguments, I think, that would say most of those dollars are misspent and wasted. Why? Because even if you get such and such a provision into such and such a bill, does it ever actually get enacted very well? Answer, no. So even if someone so-and-so gets elected with all the this, that, and the other thing, do they actually get to do what they said they were going to do? No. And it's not because they're bad people. You know, I'm not mentioning any names. I don't think you even need to say any names because it applies equally across
obviously.
The spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can just begin, I really believe this based on the hope of what I've seen in the last couple of years as we've started down this little path, if we can just take a little of our money, our actual dollars, out of that crazy mess and start putting them to work, you know, giving money to the local, you know, organic butcher or the person who's growing the organic eggs or the home delivery service that's bringing organic food to people. You know, a bunch of slow money people invested in a company in Austin, Texas called Greenling that's doing that. You know, a startup organic creamery outside of Burlington, Vermont. All these little things, are they don't solve the whole thing all at once, for sure. And they don't add up to a grand economic theory, for sure. But they actually do, to me, they're as important as doing yoga, or they're as important as the actual food that you put in your mouth, is how you take a little of your money and move it from point A to point B, thinking about healthy relationships.
Mm.
By the
you
way,
know,
I'm sorry that sounded
yeah,
like a lecture I was given there, but, you know. I get going, so you have to jump in and stop me.
No, I'm in fact I'm really happy because I don't know that this is confirmed, but I'm going to mention this to you and our listeners that we're going to do something unusual here, which is have you back on the show. I believe a week from today, and we'll confirm that after the Slow Money Conference, so that you can share with us, you know, some of the outcomes of the upcoming gathering that people can find out about at slowmoney.org that's occurring this coming week in San Francisco area, and also to discuss some of these things, because I actually as we're speaking, I agree with everything you said completely, and I come out of the whole health movement and came to these same conclusions, you know, because it becomes very individualistic and solipsistic and weird, really, to be, you know, allowing the world to go down in the direction that it is with the threat to future generations, and then consider that to be spiritual is it doesn't work for me, is all I can say. So you know, I really love these whole contemplations. But the other thing that comes up that maybe, because I think we're kind of holding into the last, you know, 5 or 7 minutes of the show here, we're kind of coming down the finish line here, and I want to just, you know, give some other plugs and stuff like that too. But one of the things maybe we can talk about a little bit, and then more when you come back on the show, you know, is the wounded relationship that we all have with money, the disconnect that you describe, the lack of empowerment, you know, where the money's invested over here, it's in the hands of experts, you know, or if people are fortunate to have investments, or we're job seeking and you know, either fortunate or unfortunate, we're consumers, you know, the winning versus losing ethos, you know, all of it adds up to money and economics as being, you know, a very kind of disconnected and wounded area in the American psyche. And, you know, so I really see slow money also as being very healing to that, in that it's reconnecting to something, you know, that's extremely immediate, basic and good on many levels, that, you know, that we all need. It's really a prerequisite for anything. I do believe we do have to do the larger organizing, because, for example, at a local level, we can't that well prevent, for example, fracking chemicals from, you know, and these companies from coming in and fracking all of New York State and poisoning all the entire water aquifer. We, you know, on a local level, you know, there's real limits to what can be done there. So I think that we do have to work at multiple levels, but when people feel overwhelmed by the larger level, such that they can't even begin, I think it's also important to, you know, to get our hands on something as immediate as possible. So I really kind of thank you for that. Now, I just want to mention again the upcoming gathering, as well as the principles and more information at slowmoney.org. Your book, which can be found at Chelsea Green Press, as well as on the website, Inquiries into the Nature of Slow Money, for people who really want to read more. And next week, when we have you back on, which we'll confirm, what I would also like to do is have people tweeting and sending in questions to you about this. So I invite people to connect with me on Facebook at Connecting the Dots for Health, as well as on Twitter by my name, to ask some of these questions. And also you can watch the conference, which has some fantastic people speaking, in addition to Woody, Tash Vandana-Shiva, one of my favorite people on planet Earth, will be talking, and a whole host of other people. And I understand the show, beginning on Wednesday, will have a live stream link up on the website, so people can watch it and then also ask questions from that. And you can connect with me by signing up on Facebook to follow me, or on my website, healthjournalist.com. And for that, you'll get my Huffington blogs, as well as upcoming radio show announcements. And I'll confirm your appearance, Woody, hopefully, for kind of a bookending of this conference, because these issues are so, so important for our time. So let me, since I've now done all of our plugs, we have, I think, about two or three more minutes here, I would like to give you the final word on, you know, on these topics. You know, what can people listening to the show do? We've mentioned joining a CSA, connecting with a slow money gathering in their town, you know, and you also mentioned investment. How do people kind of break the, I don't know what to say, the enslavement,
there's no silver bullet. There's, mm-hmm. you know, my thinking, talking, and doing thing. So mm-hmm. this is about just beginning to do something, which at first may seem a little tricky or hard or even a little scary, because it's different than what we've all been grown up, you know, being taught, just give our money to the broker, give our money to invest in the mutual fund, even if we don't know what's in there. That's just what you have to do. This is a little different. Maybe I'll share an anecdote. The anecdote is I was speaking at the 20th anniversary of the Minnesota Sustainable Farming Association this past winter, and we got into, there were several hundred farmers there, we got into a very long discussion about slow money. And way into the discussion, one of the farmers says, I was up on the podium, you know, he was in the audience, and he said, wait a minute, what you're suggesting is going to be really hard. I mean, I don't know if I really want, you're saying my neighbors are going to become like owners if I expand my farm, or they're going to become part owners of my farm, and I don't know if I want my neighbors being part owners. I don't even like some of my neighbors. And everybody laughed. And then he said, this is going to be really hard. And I said, you're absolutely right. You know, transactions are hard enough. Relationships are even harder. And then we got into that discussion, and I found myself saying, I'd like to ask how many people in this room are farming, because it's easy. And then, you know, a big roar of laughter went through, and I said, well, who told you investing was supposed to be easy? We have a world that was created by easy investing. I say relatively to me, you give your money to people you don't know, they invest in things they don't understand halfway around the planet. Hmm. And that's how money is made. That's how the greatest legal accumulation of oops, are you hearing that dial tone?
I'm hearing. I lost you for a second, but you're fine now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that, you know, that's how money flows the fastest and how the most economic growth is created. So, you know, at the beginning, it's going to seem a little like, wow, how are we going to do this? But I'm already seeing how rewarding it is, just like farming is rewarding for people who, you know, who kind of stick with it and are able to, let's say, understand the joys of hard work. You know, nothing good comes easy. Mm-hmm. So the idea that we will... You know, you say, how can people do this? It's as simple as getting together with a group of other people who share your concerns and starting to do it together. And what we're doing at Slow Money is creating some venues, some linkages, some shared knowledge. And we're still very early in this process. But I would suggest, if I can just bring it back a little bit to the specifics of what Slow Money is doing, our little piece of this is, if you go on our website, you will see the first thing you can do is to sign the Slow Money Principles. So 19,000 people have done this. Not a huge number. We're still early in this whole process. But you just sign the principle that says, I want to be counted as one of the Americans who would like to see us move in a radically different direction when it comes to food and money. Then you can become a part of Slow Money if you want. A few thousand people have done that. I'm not selling memberships, but, you know, they do exist, and we welcome people to join if you want. We're actually launching a new membership structure and campaign at this national gathering next week.
Oh, great.
If you want to start investing right now and you don't know who to talk to down the street, you can go on another page on our website. And there's a bunch of stuff listed there for things that are generally consistent with these principles that exist right now for people who can start putting their money in a somewhat different direction. It doesn't go all the way down to the local, obviously, because that's what we're going to create with one another over the next decade or two. And then you can also look to see if there happens to be a slow money chapter near where you live and plug into that and become part of the process. So there's stuff people can start doing, you know, right away. And I'd like to, just while we have time, also say one other thing about the program in San Francisco. There are so many interesting things going on there, but here's, in addition to the entrepreneurs and whatnot, but we have a panel on Wednesday afternoon, October 12th, that has Vandana Nashiva, Wes Jackson, a man named Tom Steyer, who is a extremely wealthy, you know, a signer of the Buffett Gates Giving Pledge, if people listening know about that. So there's something like 60 or 70 billionaires who have committed to give away half their money or more.
What time is that panel, Woody? What time is that?
That panel is Wednesday afternoon around, you're asking me a question, I don't know the exact answer, around 3 p.m.
I'm going to have to wrap this
time. Pacific time.
Hour,
it's on our website on the program.
But look for it on the website for the live streaming listeners, and then we'll be back to ask questions and talk with you some more, hopefully next week. Wishing you luck with the conference. It sounds absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much for being with us today and Connect the Dots, Woody, and we look forward to having you back. And I'm Allison Rose Levy. Tune in next week, listeners, for the next edition at noon Eastern of Connect the Dots.